Hi, welcome to the first episode of the Page Turner Podcast, brought to you by me, Kari Medill, and my co-host, Rob Roy McCandlist. Tonight, we are thrilled to bring you an author, award-winning author, and more recently, his stories have been turned into a Hulu series as well as a feature film. Welcome our guest, Nathan Drood.
Thanks. Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Nathan, and welcome to the show. Rob Roy, you going to say hi?
Hey, how's it going, Nathan?
It's going pretty good.
Good.
Good. So for tonight, we have Nathan on the show, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work, but he's got some great stories. First of all, he has a short story compilation called North American Lake Monsters, which has recently been made into a Hulu series. Nathan, pretty exciting year for you.
Yeah, it's been pretty wild.
Like, tell us about that. Like, you must be blown away.
It's been happening over such a long period of time. Like, the development of these things takes such a while that by now it doesn't feel, overwhelming anymore. But it certainly did for a while. So I guess it came directly out of the movie itself. Babak Anvari and his producing partner, Lucan Toe, optioned the novella, The Visible Filth, to make into the movie. And while they were called Wounds, and while they were writing the script, or while Babak was writing the script, he read North American Lake Monsters and decided to option that as well to see if they could make it into a television show. So back then, when all that was happening, that's when I was really overwhelmed. That's when I couldn't believe, you know, what a strange turn my life had suddenly taken. And since then, it's just been a process of development, you know, of finding a showrunner whom they found in Mary Laws, and then writing up a pitch, and then pitching it to different studios or different, networks, and then getting picked up, and then slowly writing it, and that all took a couple of years.
So go ahead, Rob.
I was curious, are you still actively writing on the show, or is it just based off of the short stories from North American?
I didn't do any writing on the show.
Okay.
I got to sit in the writer's room for a couple of weeks while they broke stories, and we talked about the stories in the book when they decided which ones they were going to use. And then I got to sit in and participate in the kind of like coming up with original stories for the show. But I didn't do any script writing. If they do get a second season, I might take a swing at that. But that kind of thing is there are a lot of ifs between my saying that and it actually coming into being. So,
right. And then have you watched the series?
Yeah, I haven't actually watched all of it yet. I'm really kind of parsing it out because I just kind of want to make it last a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I don't blame you. I mean, I watched one of the episodes. So here in Canada, so for anybody who's listening, the Hulu series is called Monsterland. And here in Canada, you can find it on the Crave app. It'll be available on October 31st. But right now, it's also on the CTV Drama app, which is where I watched it. And they're showing one episode called Plainfield, Illinois, which was based on the short story, The Good Husband. Yeah. And it's a really creepy, authentically chilling take on zombies. But it's got that Nathan Ballingrud twist, which all these stories have, which was what made me reach out to you on Facebook and follow you in the first place, because I can't remember being so deeply affected by a book since Harry Potter, to be honest, which is a weird comparison. But honestly, I got so frightened and the imagery, and I dreamt when I read Wounds is the name of your other book, which we'll get to soon, but that's the name is Wounds, Six Stories from the Borders of Hell, right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And so, when I first read that one, Rob, have you read that one yet?
Not wounds. I finished up North American Lake Monsters, and I'm very familiar with The Good Husband, so let's definitely talk about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I read Wounds, I don't know if you'll like Wounds, because you're my sweet summer child, Rob, who doesn't read a lot of horror. Nathan, I got to tell you, it was so funny. Rob messages me and he says, Kari, you know, I'm reading this book. I just don't know what to do. I don't like any of the characters. And I was like, well, Rob, Nathan's not writing to make friends.
No, the writing's great. Let's be clear. Like, Nathan, the writing is so great and the characters feel so real. But I want to root for somebody. And I was having a really tough time finding anybody that I wanted to root for. And I really wanted to ask you some questions on that topic. But like, that's where that comment came from. It wasn't the writing is so horrible. It was the writing is so good.
Oh, God. Yeah. Is that how it came across? Sorry, Nathan.
No. it didn't. I knew exactly what you meant. And trust me, I get that a lot. I get
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that, because I find myself often rooting for the antagonist. I don't know what that says about me. I could give you some ideas, but we're not doing a show about me. I found myself rooting quite a few times. I found myself rooting for Toni because she struggled. I mean, she was really struggling. And even though, and I know that she did something that is just unredeemable at the end of the story. And I don't want to ruin it for the people that I know are going to run out and get this book after the show. But I found myself rooting for her in that she would not make the decision that I thought she was going to make, which she did anyway. So, I mean, there is a sense that you can root for somebody, for these people who are going through. And what I love about Nathan's writing is it's about people that are just in this deep, dark place in their life. Because I find that in Nathan's books and, you know, the real monsters are people, which, you know, they are.
Right. And that seems, Nathan, that seems to be a theme throughout the entire North American Lake Monsters book is that the monsters aren't the real thing that we should be scared of. It's the people that the monsters end up interacting with. Is that on point?
It's pretty close. I wasn't necessarily thinking about saying that people are the real monsters so much as I was and remain intrigued by the notion that we all have the capability of being monstrous within us.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by people who make decisions which on the outside seem terrible, seem poor, seem monstrous, but you know, trying to figure out what happened in their life or what circumstances did they find themselves in which they found themselves in a place where doing that made sense. You know, where you know, by committing some heinous act to them seemed like it was the only call to make or the right call to make.
Yeah, like the only way out, their only choice.
Yeah.
Well, like in the episode of Monsterland that I watched, what was based on The Good Husband, when the girl goes into the room and into the bathroom and she sees her partner in the bathtub and she's committed suicide and she pauses and she goes and scrubs the wine out of the carpet instead of calling 911 because she had just lived with her for 16 years and lived with this mental illness. And it's just, you know, it drove her to that moment, whether it was a great choice or a bad choice. That was what she felt that she had to do, which was what I found so interesting, because each character faces that in each story in a different way.
Yeah. And in that story in particular, I think it was, you know, a terrible choice, and she knows that it was a terrible choice in the story. Yeah. It's in the book. It's a husband in the television. Yeah. It's two men, women, but, but it was a choice, you know, that came from a moment of abject weakness and exhaustion. And what follows is this character trying to manage the overwhelming guilt of having done that, of having made that choice. It's I guess it's just, that's an example of what I was talking about. Someone, you find yourself in a place where something happens.
And you just, that's the decision you
make.
It's
not the right choice. Yes.
Let's start from the beginning, Nathan. When did you start writing and why?
I've been writing ever since I was a little kid. I've always, thought that I was going to grow up and be a writer. And never in the sense of that's going to be a career, and just in the sense of that's what I was going to do, in addition to whatever other career I might have. If you can hear that chime, I'm sorry. I don't know how to turn the text off my computer.
We'll just call it a ghost. We'll just call it a ghost.
Let's go with that. But I didn't start, then I wrote a little bit when I was in college, in high school, and I went to Clarion Writers Workshop when I was in my early 20s.
Okay.
I sold a couple of stories directly after that experience and then decided that I just felt like I wasn't the kind of writer I wanted to be. I felt like I didn't know enough. I just wasn't equipped to be who I wanted to be. So I stopped writing for several years, about eight, I think, eight or nine. And then, you guys hear that feedback?
No.
Yeah, is that, I hope that's not me.
What was it?
I don't know.
There's some kind of feedback.
I didn't hear any feedback.
Ghost. It's ghost.
It could have been me breathing into the microphone. I'm just
I'll just keep talking.
It was in my
early 30s when I decided to start writing seriously. And that's when I wrote Ego Where It Takes You and sold it. And I continued writing very slowly after that, but regularly.
Okay. And then, so you wrote Ego Where It Takes You, you sold that, and then I'm assuming you wrote like the rest of the short stories. So you started off with short stories.
Yes.
And then you're still going with the short stories because you've got two compilations. Who are your favorite authors? What do you read? What does Nathan read when he's not scaring the crap out of the rest of us?
That's a list that's in flux all the time.
Mm.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I mean...
Bang off your favorite, your top five.
Top five throughout my life would be... Salman Rushdie.
Okay.
Annie Proulx.
Oh, yes. Canadian.
Yeah. She
wrote The Shipping News, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that, and she writes about the West and Newfoundland. I'm not exactly sure where she was from or where she lives now.
Okay.
But you might be right. Let's see. I haven't read him in a long time, but Ernest Hemingway would play an enormous part and a role in just shaping, my idea of what stories can do.
Okay.
Oh boy, this is tough because there are so many names keep crowding in. John Le Carré is a favorite, geez. It sounds like I don't have any favorites, but it's
too hard to pick, right? And you don't want to leave out. That's what I run into all the time. Like
Erin Russell is a favorite. She writes amazing, amazing short stories.
That's a nice eclectic group. That's a broad group. That's interesting. I'm not sure I heard any horror writers in there. Is that right?
I mean, I guess. Not, but that doesn't mean they're not there too,
Right.
Adam Neville is a favorite, of course, a group on Stephen King, Straub, and Barker,
right?
Livia Llewellyn is an amazing writer. I'll read anything that she writes. I mean, that's what I mean. There are just, I could probably, if I had time, I could probably throw out 40 names,
yeah,
no, I hear that too. I once read a quote where you said, "The scariest sound for me is someone crying in the next room."
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Not so much, I think, scary, but like the worst, the most unsettling, unpleasant sound. Yeah. Because there are different strains of horror, obviously, and you have the one strain which is the tropes. You know, the tropes that are almost kind of Halloween-like and fun, like the ghosts and the vampires and the haunted houses and all that stuff. And then you have the more psychological, reality-based horror, which is the stuff that really digs into me. And that's the sound of this kind of unanswerable pain, this kind of aching sadness that you wish you could make go away in someone, you know, in someone that you love, and you can't because you're powerless to do it. And that to me is the worst thing. And that's the kind of energy that, you know, fueled a lot of the stories in North America Lake Monsters.
It's just the desperate isolation of the human condition.
Yeah, just the sadness, the overwhelming sadness of so much of life. And I'm not somebody who believes that, you know, life is intrinsically sad and that, you know, that I walk around sad all the time myself, but it's such a big part of being alive, you know? And it's like, and when you have, when you add to that, you know, things like depression, various strains of mental illness, you know, this kind of pain that you can't fix, you know, in the way that you would want to. I mean, obviously there's things like therapy and medication. I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about if someone that you love is feeling that kind of pain and they're feeling it in the moment, and it's not the kind of pain that you can make go away. You know, you can't do it, you know, for somebody. And that's tough.
And you had a bunch of characters that were kind of in that predicament themselves, where at least for me, I could feel that if it was possible to help them, and this might have just been me like trying to grasp a protagonist that I could relate to or that I could root for, but I felt some of them, if they could just get the right kind of help, and I had no idea what it was, that then they'd be on a better path.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the case with a lot of those characters, and this is, and a lot of times it was the protagonists who just can't, you know, they're feeling this kind of pain and they can't get out of their own way. You know, I think about the protagonist of the title story, North American Lake Monsters. He's an ex-con. He's coming out of prison after several years inside, just trying to re-acclimate to being a husband and a father, and he just doesn't know how to do it. He doesn't know how to get over his own self-loathing. He doesn't know how to get over the fact that his wife and his daughter are different people now. And I'm fascinated by people who are trapped by the way they perceive the world. And I guess that's a little bit of a digression from where we started from about dealing with sadness and mental illness, but it's, to me, it's like it comes from the same root, you know. It's
absolutely,
yeah, it's this inability to answer that painful question, because maybe there's no answer to it.
Yeah, and he was very interesting. I thought he was an interesting character too, because I think at least twice within the story he reflects on himself as a weak person, but then kind of projected that out to his wife and his daughter as they're so weak and he would have to protect them, which was a really interesting kind of it seemed like he would think of himself as weak and then he'd be like, no, it's not me. It's got to be somebody else. And he kind of projected that out.
Yeah. Cause you can't, I mean, if you acknowledge it and truly acknowledge it in yourself, that means you got to do something about it. And that's, you know, he wasn't able to do that, or at least wasn't. Yeah.
At least not by the end of the story.
maybe by the end of the story, he's at the threshold of being able to.
That was a curious, I'd hate to spoil that particular story, but that was a curious end to that story, where it seemed like he still had choices left. Is that how you saw him, or did you see him more tied into where he was at?
No, I thought he had choices. There are some of the stories in that book. It's called a book of horror stories. But there are some stories in there that don't feel like horror stories to me. I mean, people can call them whatever they like, and that's fine. But that's one that did not feel like a horror story to me. That felt like a guy who by the end, was at least able to acknowledge the possibility that maybe he was somebody who was, you know, worth caring about. You know, maybe he wasn't that terrible. And if he can accept that about himself, then maybe he'll stop lashing out. You know, it's not like he's head or anything like that, but I wanted to get him to a point where he was able to apprehend the possibility. And that's one of the stories that, to me, felt like I had a more hopeful ending.
Right, right. No, that was nice.
Which was your favorite short story out of that book, Rob? Roy?
You know, the very first one was very affecting to me, and I still think about it, especially the very last scene of that. So kudos to you, Nathan, because I was like, oh, you know, we're going to read this book and I'm going to talk to this author and that'll be fun. And then read the first story and was like, whoa, this is going to be different because this guy can really reach in and grab hold of you.
Yeah.
and make you care about these characters. But, you know, this is a quote unquote horror collection. And I was left somewhat horrified by the end of that, but then intrigued, like what could you do with different things? And what was really nice, I thought, on each one was that they were all very different, even though there were some themes that ran through them. Everybody's situation was different. There was supernatural in there. Yeah. The supernatural was always unique. And you kind of played with some of those tropes from the genre. And, I think I really liked something about every one. I can't remember the name of the one that had they were called angels, but they were never really explained, and they weren't really angels. They were just some odd glowing.
Yeah, the monsters of heaven.
Oh, that's it. Okay.
The monsters of heaven.
Right, and that one was interesting. Yeah, they were all really good. I think that one might have been the one that I was most curious about. And you know, not spoiling it for everybody listening, but that was the one that I wanted to be like, Nathan, what was going on there? What happened?
I think my favorite. Oh, I have a message for you, Nathan, from Brody, my partner. He said for me to tell you you're a jerk because after I read Wild Acres, and I'm sorry, I don't think that, but after I read Wild Acre, I wouldn't go outside in the backyard and put the goats or the chickens away for like 9 months. Because I was so frightened because it was still out there. And I don't, I'll tell you something, and I've always meant to take a picture and send it to you. I have this little railing on my front porch, and I've glued tiles with the lines out of all my favorite stories, the first line, and I've written it out on a tile and glued it in a row, and I'll share the photo. But I have the first line. I've got the first line from Where the Wild Things Are, Call of Cthulhu, Harry Potter, and Lord the Hobbit. And I also have the first line from Wild Acre because I just love that short story.
Oh, thank you.
And
tell your husband you were just being prudent.
Right. It's still out there.
It is. It's still out there. And, you know, werewolves for me, every time that's what gets me. It's like the carnage. Everybody's on about the zombies and the slow burn zombies coming after you. But for me, it's the werewolves. I don't know why. Maybe it's just that idea that there's a monster inside you that you can't control that will come out in the full moon and start, you know, eating people.
I'm totally the werewolves. Are the scariest,
best ghosts? Monsters. Sorry, Nathan.
Pardon? No, so I'm with you. The werewolves for me are the scariest and the best monster.
Are werewolves? Oh, you're with me. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, no, yeah. I love the fact that you show, and what I think I loved about Wild Acre was the attack. The werewolf attack wasn't the biggest thing that happened in the story. It was how Jeremy's life fell apart afterwards.
Yeah.
How he couldn't cope with his guilt because he ran away, which God would, I put myself in that position. Like, would I have grabbed my gun and run back?
Well, that's what you scream at the TV, right? During the horror movie, you're like, get out of there, run. And that's what he does. Right. Cause there's no,
like their friends were being killed.
But if the monster shows up, you run, right?
It's good to know, Rob, that you're going to leave me to get eaten. Remind me never to go anywhere with you where there are werewolves.
if I find myself in a horror movie and a monster shows up, I'm out. I'm out.
Well, that's... I would like to say I don't have to run faster than the monster. I just have to run faster than who I'm with.
That's right.
And that was the thing with that story. You know, I wanted to, you know, these were guys, especially this guy. He had a very definite idea of what a man was supposed to do. And he had an idea of who he was. And he thought he was one thing. And then something happened, the werewolf attack happened, and he realized he was something different. He was not somebody who would stand and be the hero in the movie and charge into the fray. He was somebody who would run for his life. And and that realization just broke him. He didn't know how to live with himself after that. Or live with anybody else after that.
No, he lost everything. He lost everything and in the end was out there trying to get it to come back. Now, was that so he could kill it, or was it so it would kill him too? We don't know. And that's another thing that I love is, you know, the endings are ambiguous. The endings, like, that's one of the things I love about your writing, Nathan, is it's gray. It's all gray. It's a gray area.
I appreciate you saying that. That drives some people crazy.
Oh no, I love it.
That would be me. I'm like, let's get on with Nathan and ask him what happened.
No, I love it. No, that's the best stories. You don't know. You either make up your own ending or you just leave it at that.
No, you're right. And it is a lot of fun. Once you realize that's a choice that the author is going to let you make, that can be a lot of fun, because then you can either take what the author has given you with that character, especially like that one, and you know, decide what his fate was there. And I kind of have decided what his fate was. But you can also be like, no, I think he could, you know, become better, or he could make better choices, or he could, you know, do something here and kind of succeed and get back on track, and project into that. So that's really cool stuff.
That's really cool stuff. And that's a really cool book. Nathan, now, what kind of horror movies do you like? Are you a big movie watcher?
Yeah, I love all kinds of, most kinds of horror movies. My favorites are the more serious, but still not afraid to get crazy over the top sorts of horror movies, like The Exorcist or Hereditary, things like that. That being said, though, I love a good cheesy horror movie. One of my favorites are like Return of the Living Dead, The Reanimator, are extremely high on my list of things that I love. I can sit down. I kind of like retire my critical gauge when I watch most horror movies. I just kind of set that aside and just enjoy it for what it is. So it would be kind of tough to find one that I didn't like in some way.
Okay, so I have to agree with you on that. I think The Exorcist is my number one favorite horror movie. Just the imagery, the sound, and just the mounting terror. I read the book by William Peter Blatty. I've read it several times, actually. I read his sequel, Legion, as well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, have you read that?
I haven't, no.
Oh, it's good. Did you read The Exorcist?
To be honest with you, I have not. I have it on my shelf, but it's one of those I just haven't gotten around to yet.
It's good. It's good. I really liked it. Now, so writing about horror, like, what are your beliefs? So you say that you love The Exorcist, but do you believe in that sort of thing? Like, do you believe in demonic possession?
No.
No. Okay. So do you have belief? Like, what are your religious beliefs? Now we're going to start to talk about sort of Wounds here, which is Six Stories from the Borders of Hell, which was your second short story book that came out, compilation. And they're all based on, well, hell and people's near brushes with hell.
Yeah. And I don't believe in hell.
You don't believe in hell. You write about it so vividly, though. I mean, if
that's fun. That's what I'm in the same boat with you, Nathan. And I think that's what makes it more fun to kind of write. Like, you can really explore different aspects of that if you're not tied to one particular At least that's my thought. You're not tied to one particular belief strain. And but
yeah. Well, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. That was it.
That's how I feel. I think it's fun to write about, and in the way that I'm doing it, I'm having fun. And I'm kind of like a magpie, just taking things from different places and making something that's kind of my own. And I think if I believed in it, I would take it so much more seriously. And I think it would be less fun to write about. But because I don't, because to me it's all, this kind of big imaginative stew, it's just fun to play with. And these stories, the ones that comprise the second book, are to me a whole lot more playful than the ones in the first book. I got a kind of confidence from the first book in that I kind of allowed myself just to kind of have a good time with the stories in the second. And, my own personal beliefs are, for a long time I called myself an atheist, but I think now I probably call myself an agnostic. Okay. As I get older, this is something that everyone says as they get older usually, but, you just realize how little you know. And I am so much less confident about things than I used to be. I don't for a second believe that there's like some intelligent guiding hand, behind the cosmos. I don't think that's the case. But I also don't think that I can confidently say that there is nothing, that there's nothing. I just don't know. And I'm comfortable in that mystery. I'm comfortable with a lot of mysteries, actually. And I don't need to know the answers to things. And so, when I'm writing about hell in the second batch of stories, it's just, it's just a canvas. What it really stands for me in the fiction that I'm doing let me start over. I'm trying to articulate what I mean. I'm fascinated by the idea of hell as being the generative force behind love. I think, I think that love is a very, I think love can derange people and make them do strange and dark things. It can take people down dark paths. And I'm fascinated by that. And so the big conceit with my version of hell is that that's where love comes from. And so I just have fun playing with that idea and just kind of like twisting it into different shapes for each story and just seeing how that would play out.
But is that love that makes people do dark, twisted things, or is it the idea of love? Like that woman, do you remember that story about that woman? I think she was American and she was an astronaut that like worked for NASA. Do you remember that story?
Oh,
she went across the country wearing a diaper because she wanted to kill her husband and her new like
no, she person. Was she was the yeah, she was gonna go kill the wife.
Or the new girlfriend. Oh, the wife.
She okay, was so the girlfriend. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean that's definitely a different take. I never thought of love as being something that twists people in a bad way.
I think that it's a fictional conceit, but I think when you talk about, or when I'm using the word, especially in the context of these stories, things like obsession are a subset, as far as the stories are concerned, that's a branch off of that tree. People can be deranged by grief. People can be deranged by lust, by loneliness. All of those things, loneliness being the absence of love or the yearning for love, all of those things are expressions of that one core idea. And some of them are very sustaining. Some of them are uplifting. Some of them are life-filling. But there are flip sides to those notions, and that's when things can get dark and confusing and bewildering and dangerous.
Yeah, I almost want to be like, gosh, Nathan, who hurt you? Yeah. Any of Nathan's ex-girlfriends that are listening right now, damn you! Look what you've done!
My favorite cat scratched me when I was very little, and I never got over
it. And that was it. That's his backstory. He's got... It'll never be resolved.
Betrayal.
Why? Why? That's awesome.
So, Nathan, I know, because I follow you so closely on social media, I know that you are writing a new Jack Oleander story, and he was the protagonist, I think, from my favorite story out of Wounds, which was the Atlas of Hell, which was just, oh my God. I had a nightmare when I first read that about the many-limbed demon with the eyes that rolled.
Mm-hmm.
Oh gosh, that was brutal. And the people with the astronauts with their heads in the boxes, and what a brilliant concept. That story blew me away. So what future projects do you have with Jack? You're going to write a feature film, or sorry, a feature, like a full length novel with him, or?
Originally that was my eventual goal. I thought he'd be a good character to write some novels about, but then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, am I really going to write whole novels, like several novels about this guy? It just doesn't seem practical. Doesn't seem, considering my own rate of output and the kinds of things that I want to write novels about, I didn't see myself really doing that. But I can see myself writing novellas about him, you know, 20, 30,000 word stories, little quick sharp shots at him. That seems very plausible, and actually it seems like it would maintain my interest in the character too, if I was able to get in and get out relatively quickly. So yeah, the first novella about this character is underway, called Symphony of the Lich, in which he is tracking down the sheet music composed by this demonic entity.
Oh, geez. Like a demonic Beethoven.
Yeah, kind of.
Is it good music? Is it? What kind of music is it? Is it
music that drives you crazy?
Is it rock and roll? I mean, is it the devil's music? Like,
well, this may change because I'm composing it still. But there's a short story in the Wounds called The Maw, in which a city is kind of broken down and turned into a like bell of a great trumpet,
right?
Using people as reed instruments. It's kind of a little bit grotesque. I'm thinking that's probably what the symphony is.
Oh, okay. So not something we're going to hear on the top 10 anytime soon. So okay.
Something else to keep us up at night. Like music that will drive you insane, though, too. Like just the sound. Well, no, because Nathan's big on sound in his music. Like in The Visible Filth, the sound that comes from that cell phone and the sound that comes from the skull in the room in Atlas of Hell. It's just like these skull splitting sounds that you would expect to hear in hell.
The idea is that, you know, the idea, and this is, I think this is important to me too, that hell remain potent, that if you hear its language, if you're exposed to anything from it, it's like physically degrading. It'll ruin your body, you know, ruin your mind.
So not like Supernatural, where they go to hell and back all the time, and it's almost a vacation for them when they show up.
Yeah,
like if you go to hell, there are consequences, and
if you even hear it, there are consequences.
Yeah.
If you hear it, if you just catch a glimpse, yeah, like those guys come back and their hair gel still is like intact.
Yeah, they look better when they come out of hell than when they went in.
It's like a spa.
Right, exactly. And everybody knows them. That's what I like when Sam and Dean go to hell. Everybody knows it's the Winchesters. Winchesters run around. No, I really like that idea that they're like, you know, any part of that should be so debilitating that it would be bad for humans to have any interaction with it. That's kind of Cthulian there, right?
Well, that's the brilliance of it is that he thinks of those little details.
Yeah.
Whereas like, you know, and even in Atlas of Hell, when they're in the room, you know, in the shack, and just the thoughts that start swarming through their head just because they're near this skull that's emanating, you know. Oh, you never read that. You haven't read that one yet, but
nope.
Sweet Summer Child Rob is, you know, It's scary.
It is. Like, that's not my thing. I freely admit it. Nathan's a great author, and everybody should pick up at least the North American Lake Monsters.
Yeah, it's
a really good read. There's some really great stuff in there, just amazing stuff. But I definitely don't go out of my way for horror.
I do. And that's why I love it so much, because it's hard to find a great horror writer. There's some good ones. You know, I used to buy those books for a dollar by like William Nuss Johnston. He used to write those The Devil's Cat books and The Devil. I don't know if you ever read those, Nathan. But they're just like cheap, sort of cheap dime store horror. And they were good. You know, I was 12 going to Catholic school, taking the book The Devil's Cat with me. That went over great. but it's fine. It's hard to find great horror writers. And so, you know, I have you up there, right up there with Stephen King and the rest of them. You know, it's just fantastic. Great work. Now, you mentioned that you didn't want to spend, you know, a ton of time with Jack Oleander because, you know, there were other things that you wanted to write. What were those things?
Well, just like when I think about things like novel length, like that interests me, that I think will interest me for like those kind of like deeper explorations. Oleander to me is about having fun. There's a novel I am writing now about a man who kidnaps his son out of school, his little kid, takes him on a road trip. I don't want to get into too much detail, mostly because I'm still figuring things out.
Yeah, no, of course.
But I think there's a lot to explore there. I have some more. Like, I don't mean to sound like I'm evading the question, because that's not my intention. But at least the way I work, you know, when I have ideas that are still kind of nebulous, they're like soap bubbles, and if I talk about them, I'm afraid I will pop a bubble.
It goes away. Yeah.
No. So can you tell us a little bit about like your writing process? Because this is not just a podcast for readers, but it's also for writers. Do you, when you sit down to write a story like Wild Acre or Where It Takes You, do you do an outline? Do you know what's going to happen? Or do you just write where the wind takes you? What's your process like?
When I'm writing a short story, I don't outline. I generally have a beginning, and I have a vague idea, sometimes a vague idea, sometimes a little more solid, but I have an idea of what end point I'm aiming at. It might not be fixed, but it's a rough, it's like I'm looking across a foggy channel and I can see the lighthouse, you know? And so the getting there is where I don't know what happens. And that's the part that is, kind of created on the fly, or like organically is a better way to put it. And writing novels, I have discovered, I've finished one, I'm in the midst of another. I don't outline per se, but I do have to sort of have a little bit more idea of some certain points along the way to say, you know, like I can see the kind of like an archipelago of stops, even if I can't see the whole story, and having that keeps me more on track. When I was writing the novel I just finished, which is called The Strange, I didn't do that, and I took a wrong turn, and I didn't realize it was a wrong turn until I was 20,000 words past the point where I had made the mistake. And it was a demoralizing realization, and it took some time to course correct. But you know, after doing that, I was like, I just thought, I don't want to do that again. You know, I'd rather. So I plan out a little bit more. I wouldn't call it an outline, but it's definitely something more than the nebulous zone that I go into when I'm doing short stories.
Nathan, how do you know when you've made a wrong turn? Like you said, you went 20,000 words down a wrong turn path. How do you know you've made that? And then what do you do to course correct?
Well, with me, it was that I was increasingly uncomfortable and unhappy with the writing, with the story. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Let the Right One In, based on the novel.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
There's this great scene where the vampire walks into the house uninvited. I don't remember exactly why, but I think it does this to prove to the kid that it's not good for it. And the longer it's in there, the more it suffers. You know, at first it's just uncomfortable, and then it just starts to really, you know, it starts to bleed. It starts to become debilitated. That's what I think of when I think of going past the wrong point. You don't know it at first, and then you go further and further along this road, and it just feels worse and worse and more wrong. And I would dread sitting down to the computer because I just didn't like the story anymore. I was like, why don't I like this? And then I looked back over the course of what had come before, and I said, oh, I liked it up to this point, and then this is where everything went wrong. And what you do is you just delete it. You just get it out of there. Go back to the point where things were working and reconfigure, you know, rethink.
And start over.
Pretty much. You know, I'm not quite that bold. I didn't really delete it. I just cut it and pasted it in a different document.
You can mine it later. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it did mean just taking that 20,000 words and just ripping it out.
Yeah. And you just have to kind of embrace that moment, right? Like, this is the wrong way to go. I've got to get back to what I liked, where it was working. You know, maybe there's something worthwhile in there later, which is always great advice. I love that. I love writing at this time where we can do that. You just pull out 20,000 words and put it in a folder. And, you know, 3 weeks later, you're like, hey, I had that little piece in there. I'm going to go pull that back out. Isn't that sweet? That's so sweet.
Yeah. And it took me probably a week to 2 weeks to come to the point where I could do that. And I knew it, but I couldn't do it for a week or two. It's like, I just can't bear myself. There's got to be a way I can make this work. There's got to be a way. I can't 20,000 words. And it was awful. And then I did it, and it was liberating. It was just like, it's like oxygen flowing back into the room.
Freeing, yeah.
Yeah.
Almost sounds like an abusive relationship. Like, you're just dreading. It does. And then
you're not wrong.
You cut loose, and now you're free, and you can go on to have either another abusive relationship, or you can learn. Right.
Nathan, do you share your work as you're writing it with anyone? Does anyone beta read for you?
Not really. I do have a friend, the writer Dale Bailey. He's an excellent writer. And he and I read each other's stuff pretty frequently. But not so frequently and not so rigidly that I would think it qualifies as a beta reader.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm having trouble with something, or if he's having trouble with something, we'll give it to each other. If something is finished and I'm not sure of it, I'll send along to him just to get his opinion. But typically, not really, no.
So you're just on your own.
Yeah.
You're on your own. Didn't James Blaylock beta read one of your books, Rob?
He didn't beta. He read it for a cover quote, which was very nice of him. We were very lucky. Usually he doesn't read books for cover quotes. But my publisher happened to be friends with him and was like, let's just throw it over the fence and see if he comes back with anything. But I'd love for him to beta read my stuff.
Well, I like James Blaylock. I think I read The Coin. I can't remember what I read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Homunculus. He's big steampunk, huge steampunk guy.
Blaylock is terrific.
Yeah, he's
good. So, Nathan, now, because you write about all this supernatural, you know, stuff, have you ever had an experience, a supernatural experience that?
No, not really. The only thing that I have had that felt like it was when I came back here from living in New Orleans. This was back in 2005. I was talking to my brother who lives here, and we were reminiscing about when we were kids and this one house we lived in. And he mentioned something about the second floor of the house. And I looked at him like he was crazy. So that was a one-story house. There was no second floor. And he looked at me like I was crazy. And he was like, of course there was. And so we argued about it for a few minutes. And then he said, well, let's get in the car. And drove by there. And there, in fact, was a second story in that house. And I have no memory of it. Can't recall it today. We lived in the house for years. And you know, if I had seen it with my own eyes, I would insist to this day that there was not a second story to that house. And that felt eerie to me.
Because it's clear to me, Nathan, what's happened is you've crossed over from another dimension without knowing it. Yeah. It's a parallel reality, right?
Those pesky second stories are disappearing.
That's when you know, because the house is wrong.
What do you mean I have a bungalow? What do you like to do for Halloween, Nathan?
Halloween, I love everything about Halloween. I love the spooky lights. I love the atmosphere. I love the cheesy toys. I love the t-shirts and the cardboard wall hangings. Halloween, I will fill up a bowl of candy for anybody who comes by and knocks on my door. I live in an apartment building, so sadly that's not many people.
Okay. I was going to say, because do your neighbors know that they have like this, you know, sort of, I don't want to say deviant, but
all writers are deviants. Let's just get it out there.
This purveyor of nightmares in their midst. Are you like the Boo Radley of your neighborhood?
I don't know. Few people in my immediate life have any idea.
Really, eh? So you just walk around in disguise as like this, you know, this normal looking guy, but in the meantime,
he's mild mannered, but
Don't put a pen in that guy's hand.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Okay. I was going to say, that's a really good question, Nathan. What do you write? I assume you write on a computer, but I know some famous writers only write with a particular ballpoint pen on a yellow pad. Do you have any of that kind of stuff?
I don't really. I like gel pens.
Gel pens are fun.
But I write mostly on the computer, but I will go to pen and paper if I start feeling blocked. Mm. I find that just changing the pace of the composition helps unlock things. So, you know, things tend to flow more quickly. And if I can't get past a point, I will do pen and paper because it slows me down and forces my thoughts to slow down. And that usually does the trick.
How do you deal with writer's block?
Whine, complain, and feel sorry for myself.
Basically like how every other writer deals with it.
I thought he was going to go a totally different route and say wine, scotch, bourbon, in that order.
No, that's you, Rob.
Yes, it is.
A couple ways. One is the way I just mentioned. I will just change the way I'm writing, and sometimes that's all I need to do. Sometimes it's because an idea is not fully there yet. And so I will just kind of like put it in the back burner in my brain and work on a different thing. I generally have a few different projects going on at the same time. And sometimes, or often, in very different styles. And so changing from one to the other will also help. And just let the subconscious take over an idea that isn't flowing. And sometimes, honestly, I'll just, my first answer is only half a joke. Sometimes I'll just sit with it for a while, and feel frustrated by it and wait, you know, I typically don't try to force it because I typically regret it when I do. So if I really can't figure out what happens next, I will just wait a while.
And just kind of let your subconscious chew on the problem?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I guess that's when I'll try to work on something else. But I think that periods of inactivity as long as you're thinking about things, even if you're not consciously thinking about things, are important when you're writing.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we have a hard time acknowledging this, because when we're not putting words onto a page, we feel like we're somehow not doing the job. But I think the job is more nebulous and more mysterious than that, you know, not to sound too, you know, silly. But I think periods of quiet and inactivity are an essential part of writing, maybe of any artistic endeavor.
Describe a typical writing day for you.
I don't know if there's a typical one. I will get up. I go back and forth between wanting to write in the morning and wanting to write at night. And I don't know what. I'm sure there's a reason. I'm sure there's a mechanism behind that cycle that makes sense. I haven't learned what that is. So sometimes I'll get up in the morning. I'll make some coffee, make some eggs, sit down and do my writing then. It's really piecemeal. I'll try to hit word counts rather than hit hours. I know some writers will say, I'll just write for 3 hours. And if I do that, then I'm good. And no matter what the word count is. And I respect that and kind of envy it. But because I'm constantly getting up, I'm constantly distracted by one thing or another, sometimes justifiably and sometimes because I'm just having a hard time, you know, focusing on the story. So I might have 3 or 4 sessions and only squeeze out 500 words, or I might have one session and get out, you know, 1500. I guess the story's flowing. This is a facile thing to say, but I guess the story is, you know, flowing. One session will produce a lot. But if it's not, then it will just take me all day, you know, of getting up, sitting down, and just hacking at the rock with a pickaxe and trying to get to 500. The typical day is going to depend on whether or not I'm in the zone, so to speak.
Yeah, I was just going to say in the zone. And now I know. And then, so what do you use it as a distraction? Say that you're, you know, while you're on your third day of struggling to get something out, what do you use as a distraction?
I'll get on the motorcycle and just go for a ride. It's the most zen-like experience that I have personally had. When you're riding the motorcycle, you have to think about everything in the immediate sense. You know, you have to be aware of the road conditions. You have to be aware of the traffic around you. You have to, if there's weather, you have to be aware of that. You have to think about so much at once that you cannot think about other things. You know, your mind just doesn't wander. You can't get lost in your thoughts. And you can to a certain cosmetic degree, but not really like if you're driving a car or if you're sitting on your couch staring at the wall or a television. And I find that it's like a blast of wind through my brain. It just blows away cobwebs and blows away all the collected dust and sand. And it's like meditation. And if I do that for a couple of hours, I can come back and I feel like I can think again.
Yeah, like you took the words right out of my mouth. I call it things like that, accountable meditation, because whereas you can't let your mind water, you have to be in that moment, yet still you're being freed up somehow.
Accountable meditation. I like that.
That's what I call it. Yeah, accountable meditation. Do you ever think, I thought about you too, because I was like, oh, you know, I wonder if he'll write a book about, you know, being on the back of a motorcycle, like a reaper that rides a motorcycle around collecting souls or something. You know, I just saw this, you know, doing this, and, you know, and it's, so there you go. There's a story idea.
It was funny. I do want to write about the motorcycle and being on a motorcycle, but I would probably want to do it in a, you know, as an essay or a series of essays. What's stopping me is trying to figure out a way to do it in a way that's interesting to people who don't ride or have no intention of riding. And I've read several motorcycling books, and and, you know, some good, some not so good, but they're kind of all of a piece. And so I'm trying to figure out how to do it in a way that's interesting.
And well, I think anything that you write is going to be interesting regardless. You know, I mean, you could, I'm going to look for, I look forward to that because I feel like my dad has a motorcycle and he actually rode his motorcycle. Pardon?
I'm sorry. I just coughed.
Oh, that's okay. Bless you. My dad actually rode his motorcycle. He rides his motorcycle everywhere. His last trip, he rode it across from Canmore, Alberta to the tip of Peru or something like that. Oh. Yeah, and so there's a group you can actually join called Freedom Riders, I believe, and it has, like, all these different people who ride motorcycles and their stories about their journeys. But I feel like riding a motorcycle, and it's like riding a horse. So I call my horse Nature's Motorcycle all the time, except for it costs me way more. You know, I tried to put it in the garage and just fill its tank with gas, but that didn't work. And, you know, it just gives you a sense of being sort of closer to the earth and to the wind and to the trees and that you don't get, you know, driving in a car. And I always like to say, like, a motorcycle is like sailing on land, you know. It's the closest thing you can get to sailing on land because you're just so much more in the moment, in that environment, on a motorcycle. So kudos to you for, you know, because I know that motorcycling, you just got your motorcycle recently, didn't you? You just started riding like...
I rode a lot in New Orleans. I started riding again. It's been about a year, yeah.
You started riding again, okay. Well, that was, you know, Nathan, I mean, thank you so much. I mean, I think we've covered the gauntlet of questions, haven't we, Rob?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so great to talk to you, Nathan.
I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming on the show. I mean, and listeners, for everybody listening, I want you to pick up North American Lake Monsters. You can get it anywhere. You can get it online, and you can find it in the bookstores. Nathan, I found it in Rhode Island in an H.P. Lovecraft-based bookstore. Yeah. And I took it to the guy behind the counter. I'm like, have you read this? And he's like, no, I haven't. And I'm like, well, you should, but I'm going to take this copy. You can find one somewhere else. I think he picked it up. And for anybody else listening out there, you definitely want to pick it up, especially right now for Halloween. If you're looking for spooky tales to tell at your socially distant party of six people only, as well as Nathan's book Wounds, which is six stories from the borders of hell, which is terrifying. And check out his series on Hulu in the USA and Canada. It's coming out on October 31st on the Crave app. You can watch some of it now on the CTV drama app. But for now, we are going to say goodbye to Nathan Ballingrud, the spine-chilling, award-winning Sultan of Syntax, Word Nerds, and all-around purveyor of nightmares. Nathan, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. This was really a good time.
Oh, good. I'm glad you did. And a quick shout-out to my sponsor, Wayne Goodman of Goodwin's Greenhouse Supply and Service. Go see Wayne. Get a greenhouse. Grow some vegetables. Thank you, everybody. Until next time, keep reading.